Coaching as Benevolence, a podcast for people who are curious about using coaching for self-development. I'm Erin with Roots and Wings Grief and Loss Coaching.
And I'm LaShawn with Michelle Sage Place Positive Intelligence Coaching.
For our time together this week, LaShawn and I thought it would be fun and hopefully engaging for us and our listeners to explore various quotes that are famous or sayings and really understand how those are showing up in our own lives. So as we go through this process of looking at some of the words and applying them to our own lives recently, this is something that you can do as well at home in your own life. Just think a little bit more about maybe how some of the words or language is showing up in your life and how that might be informing, you know, who you are and your journey as well. And words and language can have such an empowering effect in coaching, and language in general, right, shapes so much in the world and shapes how we see ourselves and how we see the world as well. So I've always been really fascinated with understanding how we can play around with language in a coaching appointment as well as just in life. And I've always been into quotes and leaving, I'd have a quote book on my desk where I'd keep quotes regularly, or I'd write down what I heard other people say that I thought was really interesting and inspirational and profound. And I would share that when people were interested in this little book that I had. I don't have that book anymore, unfortunately, because I cannot find it. I lost it when I transitioned jobs. But at the time when I would share that book with the people who I met with, they would always be really engaged in it because they were able to kind of see a situation on their own in a way that maybe they hadn't looked at it. So by just hearing a couple sentences from someone else's perspective on this page of paper, they were able to shape their understanding in a new way and then create a new perspective for themselves and shift in how they wanted to move forward. So language, again, has such a powerful effect in that way. So today we're going to be playing a game kind of where we've numbered different quotes that maybe we've come across or various sayings, maybe even some metaphoric language. And neither of us have seen either of our list of quotes. So we will draw a number, and that person will then state the saying or the quote based off of how they've numbered their quote. And then the other person will talk about how that's shown up in their lives and maybe also maybe find new insight or inspiration from the quote. LaShawn, is there anything else that might be helpful in introducing what we're going to do today?
I can't add anything else. I think you covered it really well.
All right. So how about, LaShawn, you take a number between, you know, up to nine. Between 1 and 9. Okay. I made a long list.
All right. Okay. Here we go. Are you ready?
Yes.
Number 5.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, this is actually a quote from Amelia Earhart, and it says, "The most difficult thing is the decision to act. The rest is merely tenacity." How has that shown up in your life, LaShawn?
I would say it shows up in a lot of places, especially when it comes to, I would say that I completely agree with that, because if you're not taking action in making a change in your life or doing something different, then it just remains like an idea and it doesn't really move anything forward. You could talk about it, you could journal about it, but at the end of the day, you're still in the same place you were before. Maybe intellectually or maybe even emotionally, you might be somewhere different. But as far as really seeing practical changes in your life, I think unless you take action, and you make that decision to act, very little gets done, or it's not as satisfying, I would say. And where that has shown up with me personally is, for example, if I want to change my spending habits, for example, and I am thinking about it, but if I don't actually decide that, okay, I'm going to eat out, you know, one time fewer than I normally do, or I'm going to pack a lunch so that I don't end up having to buy lunch when I'm out. If I don't make that decision, then, or I don't make that decision to act, then it will just be do this tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And where the tenacity comes in is once you make that decision to act, I find that it's much easier to stick to it. And once you start getting the momentum going. How about you, Erin? How do you feel?
I feel this quote is kind of like the coaching process in a way, in that oftentimes being ambiguous about something that you really want to change in your life creates this pattern of behavior in your life where you don't commit to something or you don't act. And I think this is showing that it is really difficult to make a decision to act and move forward on that action because of that process that comes before choosing which way to go. Because it's when we're ambivalent, it's really, or even sometimes apathetic, it's really hard to unravel what's going on for us internally to move into a space of action. And when I think of action here, I think it can also be non-actions. It's like a decision to commit to, you know, she says action, but maybe non-action or meditative work or that type of thing. I mean, it's still action in a way, I guess. So I like that piece. And then how she framed, you know, the rest is merely tenacity. Yes, it seems so simple, but that is not true for me and for many people I work with. It sounds so almost humorous when I think of like, oh, the rest is tenacity. Like that's easy. And it's like, I don't know if they're juxtaposed that much in terms of what's more difficult, the decision to act or to persist with tenacity. But yeah, I think it's an interesting framing. It's an interesting quote that I would look at in my own life to think about where I'm struggling to act. And currently, I think it is a lot with different aspects of my own work. And it's because of that ambiguity. So I can look at this quote, apply it directly to my work today, and see that it's an opportunity to refresh my perspective on something else I could be committing to in my business that I'm currently not doing. So that's where it's showing up for me today.
Yeah, I think it might have something to do with the decision to act and the tenacity, especially since this was from Amelia Earhart, correct?
I mean, I think it's so. Like a, yeah, I didn't it's a really certain... do a lot of research on
No, it's all right. Well, I just wanted to make sure that I remembered that you said the quote was from Amelia Earhart. But I'm thinking about people like Amelia Earhart who are focused and determined and tenacious, possibly because of their personality or because it's something that comes naturally to them. So I do think that that quote evokes images of athletes or really focused and determined individuals who have a very clear idea of where they're going and how they're getting there. And so then I think it would make sense. You make a decision to act and then you stick to that. You stick to learning that new skill or perfecting, you know, that art or to honing your craft. And I think if you're really determined and focused and clear on what you're doing, then yeah, I think that tenacity would be something that would be the thing that you would have to really be consistent on. Like you would have to be, you know, tenacious and just hold on to that and keep going. But then I also think that it doesn't leave room for growth, change, evolution. And so that's where it would not really apply to me, because I'm, you know, I'm all about taking new information and making different decisions, or not just sticking to one thing, especially if I'm getting other information that tells me that maybe this at one point in this journey was the thing that I needed to be doing, but maybe something has changed. Maybe I've grown and I need to look at something else. So then it would be like kind of a cycle of making that decision to act and then being tenacious. And the other thing about tenacity that is particularly intriguing to me is when I think about tenacity, I think, you know, never give up, just keep going. And you like a dog that has its teeth on something and it's not going to let go no matter what. That is something that I feel like is rigid to me. So when I think of tenacity, I think rigidity. So what are some things that come up for you when you think of the word tenacity, Erin?
Similar responses. I like how you framed that a lot in terms of the rigidity of it. And it may feel inflexible. And I think part of the point of committing to an action is that you have to be flexible, right? There are always going to be those turning points that you're working toward if you're committed to that specific action too. So it makes me wonder, like, does the meaning of tenacity hold more flavor to it? Or is it this like inflexible thing? And so I think of like tenaciousness, like, or I don't even know if that's a word. I know tenacious is, but in like basketball defense, the player was so tenacious, right? Like, and to be a tenacious basketball player, you have to be flexible. You can't be rigid in the way that you defend, or you're not gonna it's not gonna work out well for you and your team. So I see both sides of this idea of like tenacious can be a little bit of a inflexible way of framing things, but it can also maybe have some flexibility to it. And the terseness of this quote in general is very short. And so I think that also played into how I thought about tenacity in this context, because I was like, oh, this just is like very direct and very, you know, you're on it and you've got it and that's it. And that's just not exactly how I would think of it usually. So I think if it was maybe framed in a different context, I might have a different response to the word as well. So should we move on to another quote?
Yeah, sure. So you have to tell me a number now.
Let's go with 2.
Okay, 2. All right. So I don't know who to attribute this quote to, because it's just this thing that keeps coming up, especially with BetterHelp. It's okay to not be okay. Where does that show up in your coaching, your life? And what does that mean to you?
Yes, it means so much. Part of the relates directly to the work I do with the grieving and the bereaved. And I know Megan Devine has a book centered on that concept, specifically around grief. And so I think that this shows up in our kind of most vulnerable moments where it's really hard to not be seen that we're not okay. And yet we're not okay. Or I should say I'm not okay. So for me, it really showed up there in my life in like those big grief experiences, but even in the day to day, right? Like it doesn't have to be kind of blown out to that macro level, but just looking at it at the micro level, right? Perfectionism is a drug and it's something that is unattainable. And when I think of perfectionism, I think of what you said, it's okay to not be okay, kind of like as a antidote to that, or a way to address perfectionistic tendencies that may be showing up in the day to day. And so for me, that used to show up in a lot of ways with overachievement, graduating summa cum laude, being a new teacher of the year, like all these things that were award after award after award that just kind of fed into this vicious cycle of not good enough. And not good enough, and it's okay to not be okay, are different, right? Mm-hmm. They give you kind of different life messages and different understandings of what's going on in one's life. But not good enough feels very toxic in some ways, whereas it's okay to not be okay is for me to say, I can take a step back and look at either the chaos of my day or how I approached a certain situation and recognize the gift in that situation and the wholeness that, you know, I'm experiencing as a part of it, and the edges and the places where I can have growth or make changes in my own life. And at the end of the day, not even be working toward those changes, just being content with whatever happens. It's kind of like the words content and acceptance come to mind. And when I work with people in grief, acceptance is a word that comes up a lot. I don't say it. It comes up a lot from individuals. It's something they're wanting to do in grief is to get that to that point of acceptance. So for me, one of the points of acceptance is it's okay to not be okay. And it's okay not to suppress that hard feelings or, you know, things that are going on in our life. And unfortunately, our societal structures aren't the most easy to navigate when we are not at our best or not doing okay. And so I think part of it for me is advocacy and helping workplaces and other, you know, societal institutions really think about how we're supporting those who are maybe feeling like they can't express themselves or feeling like they can't be okay. And I think that that is a really hard thing to do when you look at how systems are set up and look at the policies. But with grief in particular, there's a lot of opportunity to do that, to say it's okay to not be okay at your work. What is that? What is your workplace policy that allows for that? I mean, every workplace should have one. And so thinking about that at the systems level, and then all the way down to kind of where I started at my individual level as well. So this is a hard lesson, I feel like, for me in particular to like just really embody and be okay not being okay. Because I always feel like I need to be in motion sometimes or like be working towards something. And inherently when I'm not doing that, I have to sit with that. You know, it's okay that I'm not okay. Like that's always a state. I'm never going to be at a level of perfectionism, but I'll always be in a state of not okay, or and not to settle and say that I'm not, you know, content or those things too, but also just to think about it as a coping strategy and a coping mechanism in my everyday life as well. So I really like this phrase. I think we can share it compassionately with workplaces and with each other and be able to show up authentically. And you know, I get that word authentically in there eventually, and I finally did. So yes, show up authentically. And this is the other thing that comes up though with the authentic piece. So I can show up authentically and not be okay, and then I can hurt people, right? Like that's a fine line, and that's something else that would need to be talked about as well, right? That's a separate conversation from where I'm at right now. But just thinking about how you can have more compassionate spaces for those who want to be able to express that they're not okay. LaShawn, what compelled you to bring this quote to the table?
Well, it's one that I see a lot, like in my feed when I'm on YouTube or every time BetterHelp comes on, I talk about it's okay to not be okay. I think it's on their little thing. And I think about it because my daughter is really sensitive to our emotional reactions to her sense, her own moods and her emotional status or however she's feeling. And one of the things that I think, especially if you have a tendency to want to manage other people's emotions based on what you do, and that comes from being a people pleaser, at having a tendency to people please, it's a trauma response, it's a coping mechanism, it's a maladaptive default mode that you develop as a child, and one that I'm seeing in my daughter. And one of the things that I often say to her is it's okay to not be okay. she doesn't have to manage her emotions for our benefit, you know, put on a brave face, hold back on however she's feeling, because she doesn't want us to worry, or she doesn't want us to be upset. And, or she sees that we're upset and she doesn't want to add to it. She doesn't want to make it worse. So one of the things that I love about this phrase is that it gives the other person permission to be how they are, and it honors where they are. And it releases that tension of, if I hold it together, then that other person won't be sad, or that other person won't, I won't be a burden to that person. That's another thing that is a reality for me. And also I see it in other people as well. Often we don't hear about what our loved ones are going through until after the fact, when we're completely powerless and can't do anything about it. We find out after the fact that our loved one, you know, was considering suicide, or that our loved one was in so much pain they could barely get up in the morning. We find that out after the fact, because so often a kind of social contract that we have is we must maintain, you know, this composure, or we must stay, you know, put together in public, or even in, among our families. Men struggle with this thing a lot. Men have to be strong. They have to know all the answers. They, you know, leaders in their family and in their social group. That is an old but still very real construct that men have to, you know, face. That, and then women too. Women aren't taken seriously if they cry. Women are seen as soft or hysterical if they show any emotion, or if they show that they are going through something. You know, it's all of a sudden people lose respect for you. And I find that really sad. So the idea that you can say it's okay to not be okay is a permissive term. It's like, it's giving you permission to be human, you know, to be what you are when you are, because we're not always okay. Our emotions, you know, run the gamut, and we should be able to experience, in all aspects of our life, we should be able to experience the range of emotions that we go through as humans. And that goes back to what you were saying about society and how, and in the workplace, how there isn't always a policy, or there isn't always a space for just being however you are. If you're really sad, if you're really angry, if you're frustrated, disappointed, you know, those emotions that make you and other people uncomfortable, those are things that I believe we as a society don't really have room for in our social contract. And I think this phrase, it's okay to not be okay, that's trending on social media and that people are starting to use more often, is kind of changing the social contract, which I am encouraged to see.
Yes, it reminds me, there was the People Pleaser skit on SNL recently. and so I think that is a good example of what, you know, what goes on sometimes for people who, you know, struggle with people pleasing, but just in general too, with society, with the lack of ability to hold space for things that are not okay. And really dig into those hard conversations. And I think that's part of it too. It's a lot of communication and a lot of conversations. Those are exhausting, draining, sometimes circular. You feel like you're not getting anywhere. Take years. Those are the conversations that need to be prioritized.
That's great. Are we ready to move on to another topic?
Yeah. What?
Okay. A number for you, right? Okay. Number three.
Yeah, you give me a number.
I give you a number? Okay. So number three.
Okay. I don't know It might be these pain drugs that I'm on from the hand. I'm like, why did I come up with like these that are so fierce? But this one says, avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. The fearful are caught as often as the bull. I don't know why. Do you want another quote?
No, I like that. I like that. It's kind of like, oh gosh, I don't know if it was Benjamin Franklin or who said, those who sacrifice liberty for for security lose both, or something like that. It's very similar to that to me, where there's this illusion of control. And whether you're avoiding danger or running right head on into it, I think the bold, they're more like, hey, I'm just going to do this and take what comes. Avoidance is very draining. And I think that we can spend a lot of our time avoiding a difficult conversation or a challenging situation or a dangerous situation. We could end up needing a lot less energy to confront what we're avoiding than what it takes to avoid it. And in the long run, what we end up doing is losing a lot of energy and time, when really what we might be in our best interest, unless of course it's like mortal danger, or, you know, you hear gunshots, run the other day. Wait, don't run towards the gunshots, you know? but I do think that there is some merit in that philosophy of being bold than to like avoid or dodge. There's a lot of energy that we put into doing that, dodging, avoiding. That takes a lot of our energy. What that we could be using for more important things. I think we lose a lot of ourselves when we avoid things. And often, in my experience, whatever we fear, it's much smaller than we think, or we have a lot more power or capability to navigate that situation than we think. We often sell ourselves short when we're looking at something that we fear or something that we think is going to threaten the status quo, or, you know, our comfort zone, take us out of our comfort zone, when really, if we face that thing, we might grow or become stronger, learn something from it. I like this quote. It really does speak to the courage that is necessary in coaching. I think one must be bold to step into the endeavor of coaching, because we face a lot of things that we're avoiding, or a lot of things that we bypass, can't be bypassed or avoided in coaching in order to make strides in coaching. What do you think, Erin?
I really like how you framed this one and how it takes so much more energy to avoid. And it kind of is a little bit in line with like the flight or fight response in a way. But I like that you also circled back in on the word bold. And that's a word that I don't use very often. I'm trying to think of when I do use that word. But I love that you bring it up as a way of coaching. It's almost like a coach way of being. And something that the client brings just by showing up, right? They have this level of boldness to show up, instead of avoid whatever's going on for them. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot there. I don't know if I have an exact, a specific example from my life currently where I feel like I'm in avoidance. I mean, I'm sure I'd have many. So just thinking about how you framed it. I really like it. Do you have an example from your life currently?
Well, recently I've had to take on a new skill in my work, and it's something that I've avoided. And let me tell you, it's taken a lot of energy to avoid it. And once I sat down and worked with, a colleague who is, we're doing it together, which is really nice when you have someone to do it together. But before, I was avoiding it because I felt like I was inadequate and that I was not equipped to handle that skill because it was so big to me. It was just so big and overwhelming. It has to do with numbers. I was like, I don't like numbers. They're not my thing, not my wheelhouse. But I've been doing it for about 2 weeks, and I find I feel so much more empowered in that I was bold in going in and just being like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get the hang of this, and I'm going to be able to use this as part of my many talents and many skills that I have that I'm bringing to this new role that I have. And I find that it's really fun, actually, and I'm feel empowered. Before, it was like almost crippling. Like I was avoiding it so much, and it took so much energy to do that I was really zapped, and I didn't have the energy to do the things that I wanted to do. But now that I am taking this on head on, and I'm claiming it and I'm owning it, I think that has something to do with being bold too. It's just becoming easier for me and a lot less challenging than I thought.
That's great. That's a bold moment. Way to go.
Thank you.
Great moments. We can start saying bold moments. I don't know. But, and even in like me introducing this quote, I felt that I wanted to avoid it because I just didn't, I felt the wording felt old, mean, like just, caught, like the fearful or caught, or it just didn't feel good to me. Mm. And so I was trying to avoid saying this in the way that I presented it rather than just saying how I felt and presented the quote. So interesting, an example right here in the moment to think about of avoidance. So,
yeah. All right. So do we have time for one more, or what are you thinking?
I think we have time for one more. I have a short one.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's your turn to... No, my turn to draw a number, right?
Yes.
Okay. One.
Okay. One. Okay. So this is from Maya Angelou. And this is from her, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. She says, there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. What does this quote say to you, or how does this appear in your own life or in coaching?
Yeah, that quote is very powerful. And in coaching in particular, coaching is sometimes about storytelling from the client, from the coach even. There was a book that I read. It was an old book on coaching, like from the 70s. That's not old, but... It's called The Storytelling Coach, and the power of storytelling, right, in the coaching tradition is profound when people can show up and share their stories uninhibited in a way that allows them to say what they need to say and feel what they need to feel as they say that and share that I feel like a sacred space in a way between the coach and the individual. And then on the coach's end, the ability to sometimes use storytelling for metaphors or kind of like these quotes, weaving them together in a story in a way to help bring nuance to what someone is saying. Again, playing with language, where I started from in the conversation today in the introduction, just playing with language can be so important and powerful. And so when you share your story and you get to share your story in your own words, right? That's also something that is healing and important for people to do. We don't always get to use our own words when we're sharing our stories. Just when we think about how language is used in the educational setting and then just in our own personal lives. So having that vulnerability to be able to share in your words, like with your culture, your voice, your accents, you know, whatever it might be, I think it's something that's so powerful. So it's a profound way of being seen and heard. And I think it's something we should be doing more just generally, sharing or having spaces that create those moments to share forward the messiness of life. And it is restorative too, right? It makes me think of a restorative way of really getting in tune with oneself. And, you know, Maya Angelou is just a gifted individual. She's a beautiful soul. And I can't even begin to come up with words that can nuance what she speaks to and what she talks about throughout her lifetime. And so I just appreciate the gift to hear her words today too. And I think that's really powerful too, is hearing, not just speaking. Is hearing the words. And this is a little bit like of a moment for me where I'm trying to really take in what I'm saying, because I am working on this book and it is a lot of kind of personal story of some very challenging moments. And so what does it mean to put those out into the world, and how do I share those in a way that brings me integrity and the reader integrity and those types of things too. So yes, I went on a lot of different kind of paths there with this one. And I really appreciate that you brought this one, this quote today. LaShawn, why don't you share what you want to share about this quote?
When I think of untold story, I think about the things that we do in our life, especially as we become adults, that deny our authenticity, our authentic selves. And when I saw this quote, I was thinking more in an abstract sense in terms of the untold story, which is what we are compelled to be but are afraid to be, or what we are told we cannot be. Sometimes society will tell you, oh, you have to be super smart to do that, or you have to have X amount of money to do that, or you have to do X, Y, Z in order to be that. And so the untold story is your way, your authentic, because I believe we all have this authentic part of ourselves, this, which is our power. And it's the powerhouse that we are denied as we grow up, unless of course we have really nurturing parents, or we grow up in a society that recognizes individual worth or the signature that we all have. And I'm not saying that that doesn't exist, because I'm sure it does. But I would say our current situation right now where we are, there's a lot of push to fall in step with a way of being or how things should be and how certain people can't do certain things. I believe that we all have within us the potential to break those molds that society puts on us. So that's what I think when I think untold story. It's that authentic, pure self that gets muffled or gets dampened by all of the things that society puts on us, that our family puts on us, that, you know, all these different roles that we have to play. So that's what I think when I think untold story.
It reminds me of the word bold from earlier. It's our boldness that gets dimmed. And how do we share that authentically? I love that, what you said. The other thing that came up for me that I didn't mention earlier too is shame and, like, you know, how there's that. I think I brought this quote up before on a podcast about, like, what you shame stays the same. I learned that quote from a psychotherapist at a conference about 10 years ago, but it was such a, like, short phrase that kind of stuck in my head for a very long time. And we can't have change without storytelling, right? We can't push the narrative forward and share that in meaningful ways without addressing shame. And that's a challenging thing to do. I grapple with it all the time. I don't have a good coaching nugget, so maybe we should transition into a coaching nugget at this time and on shame, but it's something we can explore too further maybe down the road.
Yeah, I definitely think that's one of those powerful subjects that warrants an episode.
Yes, it's a big one.
So I could give a coaching nugget. One thing that I thought about was, what is your untold story? And I'm going to take from that other quote about being bold. What would it take for you to be bold and tell that story?
So good. I don't think I can add anything to that. So for the first time, I am just going to not say an additional coaching nugget, because I think that's such a powerful coaching nugget of wisdom. And I hope the listeners go out there and boldly share their story.
Thanks for joining us for Coaching as Benevolence. I'm LaShawn with Maychelle Sage Place, Positive Intelligence Coaching.
And I'm Erin with Roots and Wings, Grief and Loss Coaching.
Have a benevolent day.